Hello, this is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University, and we're back. I'm an author, psychologist, and speaker. And every week we talk about how to love ourselves, others, and a higher nature. And we talk about improving your life and relationships, career, and personal health and happiness. Today we have an amazing guest. I'm very pleased to have Marianne Williamson to the show, who is a presidential candidate and spiritual author, best-selling teacher. For over 35 years, she's spoken to audiences worldwide on healing and love. Her classic bestseller, A Return to Love, was featured on Oprah and remained on the New York Times bestseller list for 39 weeks. She has published 13 books, including her latest, A Politics of Love, a handbook of a new American revolution of heart and spirit. She also founded the Project Angel Food Meals on Wheels program for homebound people with AIDS, serving over 11 million meals. Now a Democratic candidate for President of the United States, she's been the most Googled candidates in 49 out of 50 states. USA Today says Democrats need her spiritual politics. Welcome, Marianne, to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm very excited to have you on, and I've really been a fan of yours. I've read a lot of your works. And one thing I want to ask you first, Marianne, is love. Now, here at Love University, we talk about extending loving energy without expectation. You know, there are theories of love, romantic love. I believe in Course in Miracles, which you interpret, talks about love is the only thing that is real, and love is God within. And I believe you say that love is an enlightening organizing principle for human civilization, the highest frequency of heart and mind. So tell us, what is love? I mean, how do we even define it and apply it to our lives and also our government?
In A Course in Miracles, it says, this course does not aim to teach the meaning of love, but to remove the barriers you hold against its coming. Hmm. The issue of love is not about defining it or believing in it. The issue of love is about experiencing it. Hmm. And we only experience it to the extent to which we extend it to others. Hmm. Now, as you said, many times we think of love in terms of romantic love or platonic love for friends. But there is a greater love, a sense of agape love, as it is referred to from the ancient Greek, that has to do with a love that goes to all sentient beings, basically. The idea that love is not just relegated to a particular category, and that if we see love as not relegated to a particular category or a form of relationship, then it's not only our identity, but it is our purpose on the earth. And it is our purpose on the earth not only to practice it in terms of personal relationships, but that it's our purpose to practice it in terms of collective relationships as well. That is what Mahatma Gandhi said. That is when he said that inner light within all beings not only healed personal relationships, but political relationships as well. Then Martin Luther King took that theory of love, the nonviolent philosophy, and he brought it over to apply to the United States struggle for civil rights in the 1960s. So my campaign is a continuation of a political philosophy based on love that I didn't just come up with. It has not only been talked about, theorized, but also applied in very politically significant ways in the 20th century, both with the Indian independence movement as well as the civil rights movement.
Interesting.
Right now, our human civilization, certainly in this country, but around the world, is basically run by a love of power. In order for the human race to transition into a survivable future, we need to replace a love of power with the power of love.
Mm, I like that.
That must apply to our personal relationships. It must apply to how we organize our civilization.
I like that. Now, Marianne, on an individual level and societal level, let's say individually, is it possible, are there some people that are not capable of love? I know in Course in Miracles, they say we have a seed of God within us. But you've heard of the personality disorders, the sociopath, narcissistic people that pretty much have no empathy or little empathy, and also they don't really have guilt when they do bad things. Are those people also capable of love, or are there some people that may not be?
We know of people on this planet who, because of childhood experiences, because of other factors, became temporarily inaccessible to the power of love within them.
Yes.
That doesn't mean they're not capable, but it means that something has become profoundly blocked to the point even where they might, in some cases, as we know, be danger to society, mass murderers, etc.
Yes.
The question about capable versus not capable, as it relates to the question, are some people born that way? I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
But I know theologically the idea is that all of us are born in love. So that goes into some deep questions beyond my
understanding. But then the idea of, a love society, which I think it's a beautiful idea. Some people might say that's very utopian or even idealistic. And, you know, I think you've talked about the idea that technology is bombarding us constantly with a lot of negative news, and we wake up in the morning and our brains are filled with this stuff. So how can we live in a loving society when there's so much violence and destruction in the world?
Well, there's a lot of love in the world, too. You might wake up in the morning, see a news program about something terrible that happened, but the news program isn't going to tell you about all the wonderful, loving things that happened today. And we have to claim that space for ourselves and our own personal lives to wake up in the morning and ground ourselves in not only the idea that we can receive love today, but more importantly, that our purpose is to give love today. There are some terrible things that happen in the world that happen, but there are also many, many, many wonderful things that happen. As far as people saying that it's naive to think that we can order our civilization according to the dictates of love, what's actually naive is to think that we will last for another 100 years on this planet if we do not make this transition. And I also think it's important to not only remember, but for those of us who believe strongly in the power of love, to stand on this unabashedly in the public sphere. Those of us who recognize the importance of love are not less sophisticated thinkers. In a way, it's a more sophisticated thinking. Because the more committed you are to love, actually, the more cognizant you are of the power of evil. Because evil arises in the space of not love. So those of us who are saying things like we should put more resources into taking care of our children, educating our children, feeding our children, are not doing so out of some naive view of all the evil in the world. Yes. We're doing that out of a very sophisticated recognition that if you do not take care of these children, they will be far more vulnerable 5, 10, 15, and 20 years now from now to these very evil forces. So we really need to push back against this idea that we're just a bunch of lightweight thinkers who don't understand how the world works. Really works. It's that we do understand how the world works, and that's why we're doing what we're doing and saying what we're saying.
I like that. I also like the fact you use a lot of reversal. Like some of these ideas are very unique. That we said, you know, that evil is only recognized if you know love. The other thing is I like about one of the things you said is you talked about the force multiplier. You said that with hate, people with great earnestness and I think conviction are able to increase that to a high level. But you said that same can be applied to love. And we talk about it in a personal sense. For example, you know, pay it forward, and you've heard of the random acts of kindness. So you're at a Starbucks, and you pay for the coffee for the person behind you, and they do the same. Or we help homeless people, or we volunteer. But I think you're talking about a bigger level. How can we do a force multiplier for love in a societal sense? How do we expand this power?
Well, the principle applies whether you're talking about an individual or a collective. And it's basically the law of cause and effect. What you do will come back to you. But we really need to think seriously about that, because when you consider that that is as true of a nation as of an individual, that we have collective karma, as it were. All that karma is a word, the Eastern word to describe what in the West is called cause and effect.
Yes.
We might really want to think about that. So this is not about just some lovey-dovey concept. This is about a principle that prevails within the universe.
Yes.
Also, where we need to go now, certainly in terms of my campaign, as I discuss it, we need to move now beyond random acts of kindness. We need to move into huge strategized acts of kindness. Mm. I'll give you an example.
Yes.
We have millions of American children who go to school every single day in this, the richest country in the world. We have millions of American children who go to school every day in classrooms that don't even have the adequate school supplies with which to teach a child to read. And if a child cannot learn to read by the age of 8, the chances of high school graduation are drastically decreased and the chances of incarceration are drastically increased. Yeah. Now, what's the random act of kindness that's going to fix that? I mean, let's be real. And no amount of private charity can substitute or compensate for social justice, for a lack of social justice. Yes. Do we need random acts of kindness regarding the millions of children who go to school hungry in America? Of course we do.
Yes.
And there will always be a place and a need and a responsibility on all our part to take part in that, in the private sector, in the nonprofit sector, et cetera. But you cannot leave government out of that, because the resources of government are the main channel for either the giving of the level of kindness and compassion that these children need, or the withhold of that. Remember, when you talk about something like millions of American children going to school every day hungry, going to school with what psychologists tell us is a form of PTSD that is no more severe than the PTSD of a returning veteran, we're talking about a collective child neglect here. And when you withhold education from a child, in the richest country in the world. That is a form of passive oppression. Now, those of us who believe in love and those of us who are spiritual seekers, and we've really got to stop thinking that we have a legitimate claim to the spiritual path when we're just conveniently looking away from things like that unnecessary suffering in our midst. Yeah. Now, I do not believe that the majority of people who consider themselves as spiritual seekers in America do not care about those children or do not care about the people in Yemen who are being starved in a genocidal war that the United States is giving aerial support to for the tune of $350 billion. That's not where the problem lies. It's not that these people don't have good hearts. The average American is fine. The average American is a good person. I believe that with all my heart. And the average American cares about love, and the average American cares about being good, and the average American cares about being compassionate and being just. That's not the problem. The problem is, over the last few decades, we have stopped talking about those things in terms of our public collective existence. Yeah. We'll say things like, I'm not into politics, or I don't have anything to do with that, or I'm just doing what I can. We have got to expand our thinking to apply the conversation about love as much to these big issues as we do to our personal issues. Because no American citizen can legitimately say, there's nothing I can do. Because every American citizen has a voice. And those of us who are into this conversation about personal love, I believe, need to start using our voices that way, which is why I'm running for president, which is why I hope that people in this community will recognize this as a presidential campaign that makes a stand for these issues in a very, very powerful way and will support me.
I like that. This makes a lot of sense. I mean, this is a very powerful conviction that you have when you speak. Now, the other thing is, in terms of spirituality, there is a phrase that goes, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Now, I know you're in a very conflictual kind of thing with people who can attack you. Now, do you have loving energy for your political opponents, Donald Trump, for example, or others? As human beings.
You know, on a universal conceptual level, of course I do, but I'm not a perfect enlightened master. So, yes. You know, in Martin Luther King said, God said I have to love my enemies. He didn't say I have to like them.
There you go. Okay, that makes sense.
I also realize that personal animus, personal anger, even when it is returned towards someone who I feel has attacked me or is attacking others, still keeps us on the wheel of suffering. My anger is a form of emotional self-indulgence. And so whenever it is present, I'm not beyond feeling, I'm not even beyond expressing it, but I'm beyond justifying it. I get that it's not the path and that my own personal growth has to do with moving beyond it.
I see what you're saying. That's a very honest statement. But, you know, the other thing is that you had a statement that kind of surprised a lot of people in one of your debates. I thought it was very interesting. You said you will harness love for political purposes and love will win. And I was thinking that kind of goes against people's idea that love is a soft, you know, gushy, touchy-feely thing, that it has a power, even almost a weapon in a sense, for good. And I've studied martial arts, and in Aikido, you may have known the harmonizing with your opponent's energy is a concept. Even in Kenpo Karate, we have a creed that goes, I come to you with only empty hands, I have no weapons. But should I be forced to defend myself, my principles, or my honor? Should it be a matter of life or death, or right or wrong? Here are my weapons, karate, empty hands. So I thought if we do that love the same way as a creed, I come to you with only love, I have no weapons. How do you see that love can be also a power as well, you know, something that can be used for good, and not just a soft thing?
I want you to, if you will, please email me that quote, because that was totally amazing. I would very much appreciate that. Yes. So what we have in America today is hatred and fear have become politically collectivized, which is one of the most dangerous phenomena ever in human history. We have seen this in the past and we see it in the present. What has happened in America is that racism and bigotry and anti-Semitism and homophobia and Islamophobia and xenophobia, all these things, a collective field of energy that has not only been amplified by social media, but also stoked and harnessed for political purposes by nothing less than the President of the United States. This has presented us with a very deep challenge that has already had very even murderous results already. So this collectivized hatred is particularly dangerous because hatred is contagious. But so is love. So a lot more people in this country love than hate. A lot more people in the world love than hate. But the problem is what you were talking about before. Conviction is a force multiplier. So those of us who love need to love with as much conviction as is now being demonstrated by those who hate. Love, you can't have love where there is no justice. You cannot have love where there is no compassion. You're going to have love where there is no mercy. You cannot have love where there is no proactive extension of love. Love is not passive. Love is a participatory emotion. It is the, you know, Martin Luther King said, power without love is abusive and reckless, and love without power is sentimental and anemic. The love we're talking about here is not sentimental and anemic. The love we're talking about here that says, children being hungry in America stops now. You know, when you said that's what I love about the quote that you just read, because I feel that in my own life. Hey, I just want to be a loving person. I come without weapons. But you mess with the babies, I'm coming after you.
Yes.
You mess with our democracy, I'm coming after you. So that statement was a beautiful expression of something that lies within my heart of when love says no. We know this as parents, you know. It's because I love you. If you know, you're 14 years old, you want to bring wine into the house. I love you. No. You know what I'm saying? Love?
Yeah,
no.
Exactly. So it's a loving warrior.
And you know, this idea that love never talks other than this, it's just ridiculous. There's nothing negative about yelling fire if, in fact, the house is burning down. So I believe that we need to collectivize our love. And I believe that democracy, the power of democracy, is that it is a conduit when we use it as such for the channeling of our collective wisdom and our collective love. The problem with our system in America today is that the channel of democracy itself has become something other than that. It has been a conduit more for the financial purposes and the monetary influence of a few Americans, as opposed to a bright and open channel for the wisdom of all Americans. That's what we need to change, and that's why I'm running for president.
That makes sense. Now, Marianne, you know, I wrote a book called Love Types. It talks about Myers-Briggs compatibility and love. And you've heard of the thinker versus the feeler and those kind of preferences. So I'm kind of curious.
Fascinated by it.
Yeah, Jungian topology. I mentioned I used to work with Dr. Pat Allen, one of your colleagues.
I love Pat. She's changed my life.
Yeah, she's awesome. But the thing is, the thinker versus the feeler. Now, the thinker is more logical and personal, and the feeler takes things emotionally. And you're in a field where people can give you personal attacks, they can come after you. Would you say, are you more of a thinker or a feeler, would you say, in your personal world?
I'm both.
Do you lead with one or the other, like heart, you know?
Well, you know, in terms of the whole Pat Allen theory,
yes,
I really relate to what she talks about, how when a woman is at work, she's in her masculine, and then she goes home and transitions in her feminine.
Yes.
There are different relationships. I'm leading with my thinking in my conversation with you here today. Not that my feeling is absent. My feeling informs my thinking. But in other relationships in my life, particularly with men and kind of Pat Allen thing, and relationships with them, I think that I seek to be more of a feeler.
I see. But do your feelings get hurt when people are attacking you on television? Do you feel some pain or do you let it go by?
Of course I do. Well, you know, the issue of that, if this is a democracy and we don't owe it to each other to agree. I mean, that's the beauty of the public square. It's a healthy, at its best, a healthy exchange of ideas. Yeah. Nobody has a monopoly on truth. So, hey, many times people say things to me that correct my thinking or add to my thinking or whatever. That's a good thing. Or even when I'm criticized and it's a legitimate and an honorable criticism, sometimes I see things differently. What happens in politics today, though, that is very difficult and emotionally very difficult to take is when people twist what I've said or lie about what I've said or mischaracterize myself or what I've said. That not only hurts, it hurts for a lot of reasons. First of all, it's embarrassing. It's humiliating because they turn you into a picture of someone. Here I'm a woman who's had a 35-year career. I have a career of dignity, I like to think, and they make me look like some silly wacko. And that, you know, it's such an insult. And so as a human being, of course, it hurts. Right. Even more importantly, though, where it tempts me to anger is that by misrepresenting me, they're blocking my message and making other people get a very wrong-minded view of me. Am I yet at a point where that can just not matter to me at all? No, but I keep telling myself only love is real and nothing else. It's all just the, you know, the illusions of the world. It's just get up today and be about the right stuff. But I'm just, you asked me what my process is.
Yeah,
so
that's what you're saying. Now, spirituality and politics, this is kind of something that you're bringing in that's very fascinating. Love is a political force, a moral, spiritual awakening, self-actualization. And I'm thinking back, you mentioned Abraham Lincoln, I think Martin Luther King and Gandhi as leaders who use spirituality. But in terms of someone with your background, I don't think I've seen that too often where you spend all your life as a spiritual teacher and now you become possibly president. And I'm thinking back to ancient times where we had Melchizedek, who's a king and priest, And Abraham gave him 10% of everything. So he was both of those. Also, Marcus Aurelius was a philosopher emperor. And I'm thinking of like combining those elements is pretty fascinating. The idea that the king or queen can rule justly. The priest or priestess can bring people to spirit. And the prophetess can bring truth. So do you see yourself in any of these possible roles if you become president, bringing up these elements?
Well, first of all, Jefferson, there is something called the Jefferson Bible. I mean, Thomas Jefferson wrote an interpretation of the Bible. So the idea of this, the way our political conversation, particularly on the left, has become so over-secularized and so over-corporatized, that's the aberration. That's actually not the tradition in America. And the separation of church and state is not meant in any way to, and was not meant to suppress the religious or spiritual conversation. It was just to protect the government from interference by clergy in terms of dogma or doctrine regarding what laws are passed. And it was meant to protect the religious and the spiritual, or absence of them, by the way, from governmental interference. John F. Kennedy said, "We cannot afford to be materially rich, but spiritually poor." Now, as far as my work is concerned, I wrote a book about spirituality and politics in 1997. And as you mentioned, my last book is called Politics of Love, and I founded the Sister Giant Conferences that brought thousands of women into political activism. So the interaction of political activism and spirituality is something with which I've been involved for many years, and people who know my work understand that.
Yes, it makes sense. Now, I like the idea that you have spiritual, what I call spiritual planks. I see spiritual elements in things that you want to do. I wrote a book called The Three Secrets of Happiness, and I talk about the three secrets as being optimism, gratitude, and forgiveness. And I look at optimism. I think of your work with children. You want to establish a department of children. And you say that you walk into any elementary school and you see a lot of optimism, creativity, and spirit, and that we can maybe recapture that within ourselves by helping the children. Tell us a little bit about that. How can we help the children, and why is that important for optimism?
Well, I think what we're optimistic about is the potential of humanity. When you look at a kindergarten in any neighborhood in America, you will see the entrepreneurial genius and potential of the American people.
Yeah.
We know now things about the brain of a child under 8 that we didn't even know 50 years ago. So my optimism, you know, faith is visionary. Faith is not blind. Faith simply is a recognition of the potential. And the potential of the human brain is unlimited, but particularly the brain of a child. So that's the primary optimism, and that's the American dream, that anyone should have the opportunity to actualize the God-given potential that is within them. So when I say we need to create a situation, every school should be a palace of learning and culture and the arts, and also we need to address these issues of children even before they start school, even before they start preschool, because we have children who are traumatized even before preschool. So my optimism, you know, optimism and compassion are two sides of the same coin, that you are compassionate because you are optimistic about what's possible when you are compassionate with each other.
Yes.
Anything is possible. Think of yourself. I know, gosh, I know myself. I mean, you know, you don't have to look beyond your own personal life. When people are compassionate towards me, even when I've made a mistake, you know, I made a mistake the other day, and I said to somebody on my team, I said, people need to do one of two things. Either say, I'm out of here, or stay here and be compassionate enough to give me a chance to do better. But if you're going to stay here and constantly remind me of my mistake, that won't work.
No, that's not,
you know?
That's not good.
People, you have to be magnanimous towards people even who have made mistakes. Yes. Sometimes, you know, it's easy to be compassionate towards a person who has always done the right thing. It's easy for me to be compassionate towards you. The compassion, really the test of compassion, is how am I going to be towards you if you just make a mistake?
Yes.
We are very rough on each other in America today.
Sure.
You made a mistake. Well, we all make mistakes,
exactly.
But that's how we grow. So compassion means a proactive holding of a space where people can become who they are capable of becoming.
Exactly. I think the key is empathy. You know, putting yourself in someone else's shoes is a reversal. And then you start to see that, you know, there's an emotion behind that person. Maybe it's fear, that was the anger that was showing, or other feelings. So it's recognizing that. And then you also talk about atonement, another spiritual principle, and basically recognizing a debt that you owe. And you talk about reparations to African Americans, you know, $200 to $500 billion invested in education, and also, I think you said, housing and other things. So tell us about atonement. Why is that important in terms of the spiritual sense?
It is a basic principle of transformation. And all that a country is a collection of individuals. So the same psychological and emotional and spiritual principles that prevail within the life of an individual prevail within the journey of a nation. Catholics go to confession. Jews, on the day of Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, we confess our sins. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you have to take a fearless moral inventory, and you have to admit the exact nature of your character defects in order to transform your life. You can't just treat the problem. For instance, AA is a perfect example. It's not just not drinking anymore. That of it, you will not stay sober if all you do is stop drinking. You will stay sober if you change your life in fundamental ways. It's all those levels that have to be addressed. Now, in the United States, racism was an original character defect. We have these deep, dark examples of the United States being ourselves at times the most violent perpetrators of transgression against the principles on which we purport to stand. That is our characterological DNA. We're both a country that is founded on the most enlightened and aspirational principles of equality for all, God-given rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And from the beginning, 41 signers of the Declaration of Independence were themselves slave owners. So that's our story. That's our polarity. And every generation makes a decision, consciously or unconsciously, what their chapter will be in this ongoing novel. So far, we have tended in the direction of justice and mercy and democracy. So we had slavery, but that was responded to with abolition. We had suppression of women. That was responded to with the women's suffragette movement and two major waves of feminism. We had institutionalized white supremacy and segregation in the American South. That was responded to with the civil rights movement. So the issue now is for our generation to do our part, for our generation to rise to the occasion. These issues of racial bigotry and oppression, I'm not saying we haven't made progress, because I've lived long enough to know viscerally that we have. There are also ways in which we're sliding backwards. Mass incarceration means we're sliding backwards. Racial disparity and criminal sentencing means we're sliding backwards. My plan for reparations, however, specifically has to do with economic restitution for an economic gap that existed at the end of the Civil War and has never been closed. There were 4 to 5 million enslaved people who were emancipated at the end of the Civil War, and they were told by General Tecumseh Sherman that they would receive, every former slave family of four was told that they would receive 40 acres and a mule, because this would give them a way to start over. I mean, think about this. You were a slave. Now you're told you're not a slave. Where are you supposed to go? What are you supposed to do? How are you supposed to feed yourself? How are you supposed to feed your children? What are you supposed to do now? And then in addition to that, not only were those 40 acres and a mule primarily not given, the southern legislatures of that time began passing what were called the Black Code Laws. And Black Code Laws ensured subpar economic and social and political opportunity to Black people. So if you take 250 years of slavery, you add to that 100 years of domestic terrorism, I mean lynching and segregation and Ku Klux Klan, you're talking about 350 years. That's longer than this country has been in existence. And I think we would all agree, if I've kicked you down, and I think 350 years of that kind of oppression, I think we would agree, is kicking someone to the ground. Our moral responsibility is not only to stop kicking, our moral responsibility is also to put out a hand and to say, here, let me help you get back up. That is why I believe we should pay reparations.
I see. Now, in terms of gratitude, is another spiritual principle that the good that comes to you comes from outside you. It could be a higher power or someone else in your life. And the fact that we're grateful for those who have come to the U.S. and, you know, helped us in many ways and built the country. And I think you said your dad was an immigration attorney at one time, and you guys also came as immigrants. So what do you think of that whole idea of people coming to the U.S. In terms of their contributions and things like that from a spiritual point of view?
All four of my grandparents came here escaping oppression in Russia and Poland. They came escaping the pogroms against Jewish people. So my family is an example, and I like to think that my family has contributed as much to the United States as the United States has contributed to us. I think we need to remember that. And all of us, unless we are descended from slaves or descended who were brought here obviously against their will, or we are descended from Native Americans who were here for thousands of years before the white European settler got here, who do we think we are? I mean, where do you, may I ask, where do your ancestors come from?
Actually, Spain and Cuba.
Okay, well, hello. Yes. Weren't they immigrants? We all come from immigrants. I mean, that's what this country is made of. And it is a tradition that is more than a tradition. It is a spiritual core value of this country that our hearts and minds are open to, the huddled masses yearning to breathe free. You know, one of the Trump administration officials the other day, when asked about this in relation to that Emma Lazarus poem on the Statue of Liberty, said, well, they meant Europeans. No, they didn't. There's nothing to indicate that. So what is happening now, unfortunately, is an example of not just the president's policies, but the president's assault on core democratic values. And this must be corrected. And that's why it's so important that he not have more than one chair.
Interesting. So the other thing, Marianne, is you talk about also peace and well-being. You said you want to establish a Department of Peace and also preventative, I guess, medical issues, you know, before people get sick, because we have a sickness system. And on the area of peace, I believe you said that your dad was a World War II veteran and you do believe in military readiness. But the idea that some people would say you believe in love, how can you get into war? And at that point, I want to bring in my producer, Reggie. Can you come here a second? He has a question he'd like to ask, if that's okay with you. He's a young man who's a millennial. He's actually autistic, by the way, but he's a brilliant young man, college educated. Reggie, what is your question for Marianne?
Well, hi, Marianne. Well, my question is, well, I'm a millennial, and much has been said about my generation, how socially conscious we are. But I feel for all our political consciousness, awareness, I feel like a lot of my peers don't really understand the seriousness of a war between the United States and Iran or Russia or in some other country breaking out, and the consequences of that for not just the country, but for the world. And I was kind of heartened by your reference to the U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen. And I feel like it kind of touches on this, but my original question was, like, how would a Williamson administration address this serious issue, and what role would love play in your foreign policy?
Well, great. Reggie was very nervous today. Good job, Reggie. Okay. That was good. He asked a quick question.
Very, very articulate and eloquent. Thank you so much. You can't just take medicine. You have to cultivate health. No doctor can endlessly fix you if you're not cultivating with your diet, with your exercise, even with your lifestyle, the conditions of health. Sickness is the absence of health. Health isn't the absence of sickness. And my campaign is an integrative approach to politics. The same principle is true with war and peace. War is the absence of peace. Peace is not the absence of war. And so while we put a lot of resources into war preparedness, and I'm not saying we don't need to. I mean, I look at the military like you would look at a surgeon. Obviously, you have to have the best surgeon in the world if you need surgery, but also you avoid surgery if at all possible. But you have to have a surgeon on hand. You got to have the best. And that, I think about that, we would all agree. But we also must wage peace. Even Donald Rumsfeld, who was the Secretary of Defense under George Bush, said we must also wage peace. And you wage peace through diplomacy. You wage peace through development. You wage peace through mediation. You wage peace through humanitarian assistance. You wage peace through expanding opportunities for education for children. You wage peace through expanding economic opportunities for women. You wage peace by reducing violence against women. You wage peace by reducing unnecessary human suffering. We should see desperate people as a national security risk, because desperate people are, first of all, they do more desperate things, and they are more vulnerable to ideological capture by genuinely psychotic forces. Now, let's look at the money that our country spends. We spend $750 billion on our military budget. Now, State Department, which is in charge of mediation, development, and diplomacy, gets $40 billion. And General James Mattis, before he left the Defense Department, said, if you do not fully fund the State Department, I'm going to have to buy more ammunition. Then, within the State Department, the USAID, which is humanitarian assistance, gets $17 billion. The specific peace-building agencies get less than $1 billion, and the independent United States Institute of Peace gets $1.6 million. That says it all. So you ask me what will be different under a Williamson administration. The peace builders will have a seat at the table of power. The person who heads USAID should have a cabinet-level position of power. When I meet with my national security team, the peace builders will be there as much as the military will be there. Because factoring in, if you're taking a holistic view of your body, you know that you have to take responsibility for your health. You can't not eat well, not exercise, not do the things that are necessary to cultivate health, and just make your health only about your doctors. That's why I say we need a genuine health care system, not just a sickness care system. So as president, I want, in terms of cultivating peace, I want a far more robust relationship of genuine partnership between the military. None of my critique of our national security agenda is a critique of the military. The military should have every dime that they say they need. I'm not messing with that. However, there are those who would argue that there is up to $300 billion on top of what the military says they need that has to do with political decision-making, that has to do with increasing short-term profits for defense contractors, what President Eisenhower warned us when he talked about the military-industrial complex. And then in terms of our domestic world and in terms of our health, the same is true. That's why I talked about it at the debate. If you really want to talk about health in America, you can't just talk about healthcare. You have to talk about our chemical policies, our food policies, our environmental policies, our agricultural policies. You know, you might notice in the second debate, I think, I talked about how Flint, Michigan, I said, was just the tip of the iceberg, that there are so many more. And even today in the news is about lead in the water in Newark, New Jersey. Also, I visited a place called Denmark, South Carolina, same situation. I talked in the debate about how often this is an issue of environmental justice, these things happening in poorer neighborhoods, neighborhoods of color. You can't just talk about what we're going to do once a problem exists. You need a president who is looking on the level of cause and knowing that there are problems that already exist that just haven't shown up yet, and problems that will exist if we don't deal with them on the level of cause.
Yes, very, very passionately said. Now, Marianne, the other thing that's very interesting is you talk about the economics of love. And the idea that rich control a lot of the resources and people that don't have that may suffer. Now, I'm kind of curious as to your personal view of money in the spiritual sense, because there are a few views. For example, there's a prosperity affirmative thinking. You know, Catherine Ponder, Wallace Wattles, and Prayer of Jabez will say you claim riches, it comes to you, you visualize it. Then you have the ascetics who say that the love of money is the root of all evil, and money is a non-universal force that's a secular love. And I wrote a book called Invincible You, where I talk about money is loving energy in some ways, that you can consciously use it to help other people to flow throughout the world. And if you do work that you love, in Spanish we call it don, a talent, don divino, you know, whatever it is, caretaking, teaching, writing, whatever it is, you receive this thing called money, and then we use that to buy goods and services, and we appreciate that coming from others. So it's kind of like a circle of love. So I'm kind of curious, what is your view on money? Is it money entirely bad or good, or does it depend on how you use it?
Money is neutral, like all things in the material world. That it has to do with how consciousness is using it. For what purposes is it being used? I too wrote a book about it called The Law of Divine Compensation. And I totally agree that it's energy. And I totally agree that when there is love, money is one of the ways that the abundance is expressed. However, that becomes a dark conversation when you use it in any way to distract yourself from recognition of situations of societal injustice. Yes. You have 1 billion people on this planet. They're called the bottom billion. And they live on less money than the equivalent of a dollar and a quarter a day. We have 12,000 children who starve every day on this planet. Don't talk to me about how, oh, they just need to think differently. No, we need to think differently. We need to think differently in order to provide a level playing field. That's the thing. I mean, on one hand, we can talk about all of those things that you've discussed, but if someone has had some opportunity, they've been loved, cared for, fed, and educated, particularly in the first few years of life, the opportunity to practice all that loving philosophy is going to be much greater. And for those of us who are into a loving philosophy about money or anything else, to deny that is not very loving.
That makes sense. And, you know, Maslow talked about the hierarchy of needs. So you have to take care of the lower level needs first, you know, which is food, survival, and then you can get to the higher level self-actualization. In terms of spiritual ideas, One thing I like about the Course in Miracles, which you've interpreted in your books, is the idea of surrendering. You said that the word relax was something that really affected you. And we're often striving for, you know, you said ego-related things, and we don't let the higher power, God, whatever we call it, bring the goodness to us, especially Western society, and also males have a hard time doing that, just surrendering and as opposed to striving. How do we surrender more in the spiritual sense to let the good come to us?
That's, I think, what prayer and meditation do. They align with a condition of within yourself where you are. There's a prayer. I take the second place to gain the first. That you, when you step back with your ego, a higher aspect of who you are comes forward.
Yeah, in martial arts, there's something called the hara, which is 2 inches below your navel. It's kind of like chakra. It's your intuition. So listening to the mm-hmm. higher intuition. I like that you said that you have to surrender what you desire most. So there are people that need to have a love relationship. They still keep thinking about that. But you said give that to God, a higher power, and then let that come to you naturally. And then also you talk about the special versus the holy relationship. And we often see the, you know, the so-called romantic where you want the person to fill your needs, but then you feel disappointed, as opposed to two people that are self-actualizing and bringing light to the world. How do you see that as a positive relationship, the holy relationship?
Well, I think the idea here is that we tend to look for love in our culture from a place of feeling broken, wanting someone else to fix us, feeling incomplete and wanting someone else to complete us. I think the healthy notion of love is that we're already complete. Mm-hmm. And our task is not to go out there and find someone to complete us, but to share from our abundance and from our completion in order to make the world a more beautiful place. Oh. You know, it's a lot easier said than done. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all have our broken places. We all have our blind spots. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to know all this stuff. It's another thing to practice it 24/7 yes. in every area of our lives. But that's right. The journey. That's the journey, is to face within ourselves the places, not just where it's easy, but the places within ourselves where it's hard. And where we are not making it, we have a responsibility, and we have a responsibility as citizens. Not only must we be vigilant in our own personal lives, where am I not living up to who I say I am, and where do I need to change? Mm-hmm. But as citizens, we need to help our country do that. We have to love our country the way we need to love ourselves, but to be very honest about our country the way we're very honest about ourselves. To be willing to look at the places where this country is not who we say we are. We're not standing on the things we say we believe in domestic policy and in international policy. And to me, a leader is someone who should be guiding that process and navigating that process in a loving but a radically transparent and honest way about what's true in this country. Exactly. And that's why I'm the president. And that's why I hope the people will go to MaryAnn2020.com and support me.
Definitely. We're going to talk a little bit about that in a couple of minutes. But
okay. I'm sorry. I only have a couple.
Well, that's great. Well, in that case, I want to invite everyone to go to your website. And how can people help you? Because I know you need to have a certain number of unique donors and other things. What do you need to get in the next 2 weeks to get on that third debate?
I need money and I need buzz. I think a lot of people, particularly in the higher consciousness and health and wellness space, have not necessarily been in the cultural habit of giving to political campaigns.
Yes.
And sometimes people think, well, all I can give is 10 bucks. 10 bucks is a lot, particularly if you give it every month, let's say.
Yes.
I do need first-time donors in order to make the 4,000 or 5,000 that I still need by August 28th. But any amount whatsoever. And also, given the fact that I do not have the kind of money and I do not have the kind of institutional support that a lot of candidates have, I need you to shout it from the mountaintops. I need you to put it on your Instagram. I need you to put it on your Facebook. I need you to talk about it on Twitter. I need you to defend me when you hear them lying about me. I need you to speak your mind and support, make your own personal endorsement, and ask other people for money too. If somebody says, well, I support it, then say, really, have you sent a check? Did you write a donation? And also just for people to understand what the money is for. You know, I think of my campaign as like a bonsai tree. It's just like every other campaign. It's just littler. So whereas, let's say, a traditional candidate will have 35 field organizers in a state, I'll have 3. So we have everything they have. It's not as big and it's not as many people.
Exactly.
And
well,
Mary,
I want to do something here. I want to, Love University, we're going to actually purchase 10 of your items on your website to donate to people that call into the first 10 callers that call into the show. I know you have some nice caps and some nice shirts, so we'd love to do that for you. And maybe have you back on again. We'd love to have you come on. It's been wonderful. I felt the loving energy today from you.
Thank you so, so much. I appreciate having this conversation with you.
Yes.
Because you hold the, you know, the conversation of love and in a very serious way,
yes,
bringing in politics. I'm so grateful to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Well, ma'am, good luck, and we'll see you next year, 2020. Fantastic.
God bless you, sir.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. And that was an amazing interview we just had with Marianne Williamson. We talked about her spirituality, her politics, and her desire to be president of the United States and make an impact on the world. We want to make a special offer for the first 10 people who call or contact us. We're going to send you a free gift from Marianne Williamson's website, as well as a Love University gift, a double package. Simply contact us at loveuniversitylove@gmail.com or call us at 310-226-8090. Leave us your information, your contact, and your address where we can mail it to you. We also have another special offer, is what we call the Love U Challenge. That's love, the letter U, where you have an opportunity to meet your compatible partner if you're single. I wrote a best-selling book called Love Types. It talks about Myers-Briggs compatibility and personality in love. So you can write to us, tell us a little bit about yourself and who you want to meet as an ideal mate, and we can bring you on the show and compatibly match you with individuals and send you out a nice evening, a nice time with this individual to get to know them, and possibly find your soulmate. And finally, if you like the show, we would love it if you could nominate us for the Streamy Awards. That's Streamy, which are awards related to the best online video content. And they have a category for the best humanitarian show that helps the world and community. Love University, that's our desire to help transform the world one person at a time, to help you bring love, passion, and power into your life, and to extend loving energy without expectation. So whether we help you improve your relationships, your finances, your career, your love, and your health and happiness using positive psychology, and we have a lot of amazing guests that come on the show, like Marianne that just came on. So tune in every Wednesday at noon, and we have something special for you. Again, you can look at us at loveuniversity.love. You can also like us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Love University students, until next time, put away your notepads, your iPads, your phones, your notepads, everything else. Have a wonderful, amazing week of love and happiness. This is Love University. Class is now dismissed. Dr. Alex Avila.